It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief and the epoch of incredulity. I practiced saying that and probably still said it wrong. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. This phrase is how Charles Dickens starts out his 1859 novel, The Tale of Two Cities. It's a book all about the word destiny. And in the church, some might not like that term, destiny. But you need to understand, destiny is simply an event or something that will happen or necessarily happen to a particular person or thing in the future. And when you're dealing in Old Testament prophecy, then you understand they are, in a sense, and actually are, foretelling the future. More importantly, with the future they're telling is what God says will happen. And since God knows all, and God is all, then those events that we are learning are about as close to the word destiny, to destined to happen, as I can possibly understand. Welcome to our study. Major messages from the minor prophets. And today we're going to arrive in the book of Obadiah, and be very careful how you turn to it, because it is by far the shortest book among all the prophets, even the shortest in the Old Testament. 21 verses long. Can I just tell you, he almost didn't make the cut. This is going to be a 10-week sermon series, and I got to tell you, I bristle a little bit at a 10-week sermon series. For some reason, 9 weeks sounded so much better. And so originally, since he isn't officially prophesying to the nation of Israel, Obadiah almost got cut. But I just couldn't let it go. Because we don't want to discount his message, because the message is short. Obadiah, verse 1, chapter 1, verse 1 reads, "The vision of Obadiah, this is what the sovereign Lord says." Like the other prophets that we've looked at and are going to look at, God has spoken. And it's not the prophet's job to make it long or short. They are but the messenger. The messenger does not write the message. They simply need to deliver that which was spoken. So hopefully by now you didn't turn past it, because it's only about a page long in your Bible. You found the book of Obadiah. And this is one of those cases. Remember I told you when I started this series, I'm not into giving you history lessons. But this is one of those times when the history is important, because where Obadiah is delivering his message is after the fall of both Israel and ultimately Jerusalem to Babylon. We're around 586 BC when those events happen. However, it's also prior to the fall of Edom in 1553 BC. So Obadiah is delivering his message somewhere in between these 30-some years. Now, I got to give you my reminder in case you don't remember, or maybe this is the first week that you tune in to us here. God's people at this point are placed in captivity, and you're probably thinking, wait a minute, last week we didn't even have the fall of Israel, let alone Jerusalem, and the book deals with this bitter rivalry between the two nations, but we've done something that's kind of unheard of. We've taken a time jump. Yep. These books that we're doing them in book order. They're not in chronological order. So all of these events are happening, and we're dealing with all of these things between the nation of Edom and the nation of Israel, and it all happens. And so this morning we have a headline that says, "Spoken, a raging fuel, and a resilient fire, and a resilient flame creates a roaring fire." So next week we'll jump back in time where we're kind of back into the flow. But today we're going to look at this story of Israel and Edom. And well, it is a story, and to understand the story, you know where you have to start the story, right? All the way back at the beginning. And this story is really the tale of two brothers. Genesis chapter 25, verses 21 through 26 says, Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was childless. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her. And she said, why is this happening to me? So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. The two people from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other. The older will serve the younger. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment. So they named him Esau. After this, his brother came out, and he was grasping at Esau's heel. So he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. By the way, 60 years old, we have a thing going on in our neighborhood where it seems like everybody in the neighborhood is having babies. My wife is not allowed to drink water from our neighborhood. We do not need this right now. We're all good. But when I talk about Jacob and Esau, this is one of those stories that it's just kind of familiar to us, right? This is one of those stories they tell you when you're little, and they do it in Sunday school, they do it in children's church, they do it in VBS. It's one of those stories that just kind of tells, and well, they are twin brothers, but they are as different as night and day. They don't look alike. They don't act alike. They don't enjoy doing the same things. I understand this, but I don't have twins. I do have a set of boys that they're as different as night and day. But for these boys, the battle began in the womb. So it makes you kind of feel sorry for mom, right? They're having their tussle in the womb as to who gets to come out first, right? Who gets to go down first? Because first was important. And one comes out, and how bad was the battle? The second one comes out, and it says that literally the hand of the second was holding on to the heel of the first. I am certainly glad that none of you guys had to endure that kind of labor. I know Taylor just went through like 40 hours of labor. At least it was only one. Right? She didn't have two come battling to get up, to get out. His grasp, the second one, Jacob, never ended. And he manipulated Esau out of his birthright and outright stole his blessing, for which Esau threatened in Genesis chapter 27, verse 41, I'm going to kill you. So Jacob did what any smart brother would do when he's done something like that. He ran. He got out of Dodge. He went somewhere else, and he started his own life. Now, don't be too concerned, because eventually the two brothers would come back together. And in Genesis chapter 33, verse 4, they kind of make amends. They bury the hatchet, if it will, and not in Esau's skull. So they make peace with one another. But remember the prophecy that was given to Rebekah. In your womb is not just two brothers. There are two nations. And that prophecy is fulfilled, because Esau would go on to become the father of the nation of Edom. And Jacob, as we all know, eventually his name got changed to Israel. He had some sons. He went down to Egypt. He came back with Moses, brought them back. They crossed the Red Sea. They entered into the land. And today we know Jacob's tribe, people as Israel. And while Jacob and Esau seem to mend fences, you should know the nations that came from them never did. I'm in Numbers chapter 20, verses 17 through 21. Israel is on their way back to the promised land. and they say, you know what? We can either go all the way around or we could take a shortcut. We could pass by our cousins and nephews and we could pass through their land and get there a whole lot quicker. So they ask permission, which is probably a good thing, because you never enter your brother's room without asking permission, right? It's going to end badly. Joshua will learn this later. You never enter your sibling's room without asking. It's just not going to go well. And this was Edom's response. I'm in Numbers chapter 20, verses 17 through 21. Please let us pass through your country. We will not go through any field or vineyard or drink water from any well. We will travel along the king's highway, which would have been the main highway through the land, and not turn to the right or to the left until we have passed through your territory. But Edom answered, you may not pass through here. If you try, we will march out and attack you with the sword. The Israelites replied, we will go along the main road, and if we or our livestock drink any of your water, we will pay for it. We only want to pass through on foot, nothing else. Again, they being Edom, answered, you may not pass through. Then Edom came out against them with a large, powerful army. Since Edom refused to let them go through their territory, Israel turned away from them. So it's like, brother asks you if I can come into your room and you hang a sign up that says, no brothers allowed, right? We've never done something like that, right? It's like somebody asks you to use your stuff, and so you go around and start sticking labels on all of your stuff. This is mine, this is mine, this is mine, this is mine. Edom is determined. We know the history. We know the past. We know what your father of father of fathers did, and you're not welcome in my territory. And so then it happens. The battle begins. Israel, the 10 tribes had already fallen. Babylon is now on the scene. Jerusalem, the capital of Judah, is under siege. And Jerusalem is about to fall. And this is where Obadiah is writing. And again, he's not writing to Israel. He's writing to Edom. Because their behavior while Jerusalem fell was something that, well, I'll just let you judge for it. What did Edom do while Jerusalem was falling? Obadiah says they stood and watched. Verses 10 and 11, because of the violence against your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. You will be destroyed forever. On the day you stood aloof while stranger carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. So as Jerusalem was under siege, instead of coming to their brother's rescue, instead of making saying, I'm my brother's keeper, they said, you know what? We're going to sit this one out. We're just going to enjoy the show. After all, they're sort of getting what they deserve, right? Well, that'd be, I guess, okay if that was all they did. But as Obadiah continues in verse 12, we find out, they rejoiced in suffering. You should not gloat over your brother in the day of his misfortune, nor rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor boast so much in the day of their trouble. So not only were they standing there watching, they were cheering for Babylon. Go get them! This is what we want to see. Yeah, take the city down. We're tired of them. And when Jerusalem fell, let the party begin. And as the party continued, well, Edom took another step. Not only did they stand and watch, not only did they rejoice in suffering, we find out in verse 13, they pillaged and they plundered. You should not march through the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor gloat over them in their calamity in the day of their disaster, nor seize their wealth on the day of their disaster. So Jerusalem is being carried away into captivity, and Edom is basically dividing up the spoils that the Babylonians left behind. They're going through the cities and they're looting the stores. They're taking people's stuff. All because, well, they had the right? After all, Jacob stole it from Esau. Therefore, technically, what I'm not really stealing, I'm just taking back what's rightfully mine, right? But that's not all they did. That's pretty horrible, right? Oh, no. Understand that as the siege of Jerusalem happened, some of the Israelites escaped, and they were headed out of town. And the Edomites saw them, and so they decided, how about we give the Babylonians just a little bit of help? And so what did they do? They ambushed and seized. Verse 14 says, you should not wait at the crossroads and cut down their fugitives, nor hand over their survivors on the day of their trouble. Wow. Really? The people that managed to escape the calamity, Jerusalem is on fire, everything is being leveled, and somebody escapes, and the Edomites said, oh, no, not so fast. Hey, Babylonians, we caught a few over here. Why don't you come and get them? Really? And here's the problem. Often, we see people's lives under siege, and quite honestly, I don't know that we're much more compassionate than Edom was. We look at people whose lives are falling apart or in distress, and I don't want to get involved in that. It's way too messy for me. So we just kind of stand and watch. Or maybe the person whose life is under siege has done us wrong in the past, and we're like, yes, you're going to get what you deserve, and man, bring me a bucket of popcorn, because I'm going to watch it happen. And I'm going to enjoy every minute of it. And when it's all done, I'm going to have a party. Maybe we even take the opportunity to take some, I don't know, maybe not physical plunder, but maybe some self-plunder in other people's troubles. See, I told you they shouldn't have done that. I told you, look at their life and look at my life. You see what? I'm going to tell you, I'm a lot better than they are at this. Maybe we just can't help ourselves. And we see that life, and maybe they're gasping for air, and their hand is going up, and they're drowning, and you know what? We like, instead of lending them a hand, we take the boot and just make sure they don't come back up. Yeah, you know what? Somehow, that just does not seem to be the command to love your neighbor as yourself, is it? Why would people act this way? Why do we act this way sometimes? The good news, in his very short message of only 21 verses, Obadiah takes some time to explain why Edom did what it did. And it all comes down to the word pride. And their pride was, this could never happen to us because we aren't you. And they had placed their trust in several things. First of all, they were trusting in their position. Verses 3 and 4 read, you should not wait at the crossroads to cut down their fugitive, nor hand over their survivors on the day of their trouble. Though you soar like eagles and make your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. So Edom was in the hill country. They were up on the side of the mountain. They actually were cave dwellers, sort of. Their cities were built in the side of the mountain. And they were trusting the fact that in order for you to capture us, you've got to come up the mountain. And if you know anything about military, that's a bad position to be in because you're going up and they're shooting down. And you know what you are? It's called a sitting duck. And Edom was trusting in the fact we are secure because of where we are. They were also trusting in their knowledge, verse 8 tells us. In that day, declares the Lord, will I not destroy the wise men of Edom, those of understanding in the mountain of Esau? So they thought they had it all figured out. They had a plan. I mean, Babylon had conquered everybody else they come up against, but not this one. We know what we're doing. we've got all this knowledge. We've got wise men that are going to lead us. We trust them. And if my position and my knowledge fail me, don't worry. They were trusting in their military might. Verse 9, you warriors, Teman, will be terrified, and everyone in Esau's mountain will be cut down in the slaughter. They were well armed. Not only were they well positioned, not only did they know how to fight, they had the muscle. They had the weaponry. They were prepared to defend their territory. Ooh. Surely you see what's going to happen, right? Because not only did they trust in their position and trust in their knowledge and trust in their military might, they double-covered themselves. It says they were even trusting in their allies. All your allies will force you to the border. Your friends will deceive and overpower you. Those who eat your bread will set a trap for you, but you will not detect it. So you get the picture. They had the best place to fight from. They had the best people to fight with. They had the best knowledge of how things work. But just in case they were overrun, they had gone out and signed peace treaties with all the other nations around them so that if they got attacked, those people were responsible for coming and helping them defend their territory. Does this sort of sound familiar to you? A place that thinks it's secure because of its position? A place that thinks it's secure because they think they got it all figured out? A place that thinks it's secure because, you know what, we got the best military there is. And a place that thinks it's secure because, you know what, we signed a peace treaty with everybody and everybody owes us something. Wow. Just like last week, I see much of Edom's attitude. In the attitude of our nation, and unfortunately, in the attitude of our churches today. I can see this. We think, onward Christian soldiers, I am here to defend the territory. What territory are you defending? We are America, mighty America. We will not fall. United we stand. How united are we really? We've gone to a lot of trouble these days to try to make ourselves secure in ourselves. And maybe this is why we need to take a good lesson from the nation of Edom. Because you know what happens? We go from the tale of two nations to the tale of two destinies. I'm in verses 18 of Obadiah. Jacob will be a fire and Joseph a flame. Esau will be stubble, and they will set him on fire and destroy him. There will be no survivors from Esau. The Lord has spoken. So let me make sure I explain some of the terminology here, because it's not obvious at first. You have to actually go back and do a little history of research. Jacob the fire would have been a reference to the southern tribes, the two southern tribes of Judah. Okay? So that's who Jacob is. And Joseph the flame would have been a reference to the 10 northern tribes of the nation of Israel. So those tribes that you stood and watched, those tribes that you rejoiced and cheered, those tribes that you pillaged and plundered, those tribes that you ambushed and seized, they're the flame and they're the fire. So what is Edom? They are the nation from Esau. They're the stubble. Yuck. They're the stubble. History did not actually predict their extinction of every single descendant of Esau, but instead the extinction of the Edom culture. is being consumed by Jewish influence, something that I'm sure at that day and time, with Israel away in captivity, their key capital city in flames, Esau's tribes, Edom, hosting the party, thought could never happen. However, I'd like to read not from the Bible at this point. I want to read you from a history book. Because guess what? The prophecy for Edom, from where we stand, is history. The Edomites were conquered. The conqueror led to forced conversion of many Edomites to Judaism, effectively integrating them into the Jewish population. The integration was significant and has blurred the distinctiveness of the Edomite identity over time. Following their conquest, many Edomites may have migrated to the surrounding areas. Some historical sources suggest that a portion of the Edomite population moved northward into the region that is part of modern-day Jordan. Over the following century, the Edomites gradually assimilated the culture of the regions they settled in. By the time of the Roman Empire, when Christ arrives on this planet, the distinction between Edomites and their neighbors had completely vanished. Let that send the culture up your spine for just a minute. God spoke it. We see no way it could happen. But guess what? It is now history from where we stand. Well, that's all real good, Barry. But why do I care? This happened thousands and thousands of years. Why on earth do I care that Edom fell? That Edom is gone? And well, that's because this is a prophecy not just for Edom, but a warning for all. Verse 15. The day of the Lord is near for all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your head. That kind of sounds familiar. Maybe that's Luke chapter 6, verse 31. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So, again, we're here in context with a term, and I told you that the day of the Lord has two meanings to it when you look at it in the Old Testament. It can either be a time of prolonged suffering, but in this case, it's option number two. We are now talking about the day when someday Christ will return and claim that which is his. 2 Peter verse 3:10 says, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief. The heavens will disappear with a roar. The elements will be destroyed by, there's our word, fire. And the earth and everything done in it will be laid to bare. It's going to be a day of judgment. Hebrews chapter 9, verses 27 through 28 says, just as people are destined to die once after they face judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many. And he will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. Okay? We have a prophecy of another day of disaster. That isn't history yet for us. This is still a prophecy that is somewhere in my future. And I have to tell you something. When this day comes, the results are not going to be based on a mathematical equation designed to determine whether or not if you are a good person or not. Because we absolutely already know the answer to that question. Paul tells us in Romans chapter 3, verse 10, as it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. Okay? So, if judgment isn't based on my results, what is it based on? It's based on your relationship. Matthew chapter 7, verses 21 through 23 read, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and not drive out demons in your name and perform many miracles?' Then I will tell them plainly." So he's not going to basically go in some kind of a little riddle, nothing that you have to figure out. He's just going to give you the straight truth, and here it is. "I never knew you. Away from me, evildoers." That's one destiny. What about the other? I mean, there's got to be a do-over or a get-out-of-jail card, or there's got to be something there. Understand, this is that day. And there are no do-overs. But there is an alternative destiny. We're back in Obadiah, the last two verses. I'm in verses 20 and 21. "This company of Israelite exiles are in Canaan, will possess the land as far as Zephra. The exiles from Jerusalem who were in Shephard will possess the towns of Negev. Deliverers will go up from Mount Zion to govern the mountains of Esau. The kingdom will be the Lord." So for those who have truly placed their faith in Jesus, we need to understand this thing that we call the day of the Lord is a day of deliverance. Luke tells us about it in Luke chapter 21, verses 27 through 28. "At that time, they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. When these things begin to take place, stand up, lift up your hands, because your redemption is drawing near." A day of deliverance and a day of redemption. And if you're one of those ones who Jesus knows you and you know Jesus, you understand what the day of the Lord is, right? It is a day of victory. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 51 through 57. "Listen, I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will be changed in a flash, in a twinkling of an eye, the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed. For the perishable must clothe itself in imperishable, and the mortal in immortality. When the perishable has been clothed, and the imperishable and the mortal in immortality, then the saying is that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, he gives us victory through the Lord Jesus Christ." Two destinies. So now I'm standing here, and I'm looking back at history, at the prophecies that Obadiah put out there, and they all came true. He didn't miss a single one. This was not a Nostradamus prediction where he says like 95% or 80%. He got 100%. So I'm looking at my past, and I'm staring at my future, and I began to think, the Lord has spoken. This isn't just a tale of two brothers, or a tale of two nations, or a tale of two destinies. It's the tale of two destinations, folks. Matthew chapter 7, verses 13 through 14. "Enter through the narrow gate. For wide is the gate, and broad is the road that leads to destruction. And many enter through it. But small is the gate, and narrow is the road that leads to life. And only a few find it." So as I'm standing here today looking forward, I am presented with two roads. One road is wide. It's well lit. It's got neon signs around it, and it says, "Hey, come and party." all the way to the end of the road. And the other side really may not be a road. It's more like a trail. It's a path. It's got a little bitty entrance that if you are looking real careful, you'll drive right by it because you'll never see it. And when you go through the entrance, the road kind of winds and twists and goes uphill, and it's not going to be smooth sailing, and it's going to be a lot of work. But both of them have different places they end. Matthew tells us, and these are the words of Jesus, that one ends in destruction, Edom. The other ends in life, Israel. And I have a question for you. Today, this day, what path are you following? Which one have you chosen? You do notice there is no in the middle, right? There is no third fork in the road. It's either wide or narrow. It's either destruction life. It's either do it my way or follow Jesus. That's it. And just like the nation of Edom, as they watched Jerusalem fall, I have a choice. Today. Today, I can choose my destination, and at the same time, I can choose my destiny if I decide to choose Jesus as my Lord and Savior.